While the Highliner was in flight, one had chewed its way into a navigation chamber, so that its face appeared outside Grodin's tank, peering in with a curious, wide-eyed expression. "So pleasant in here," Demure thought without forming words as he absorbed the story. With enlarged nostrils, he drew in a deep breath of the sharp, rich melange. Humans with dulled senses compared this pungent scent to strong cinnamon. But melange was so much more than that, so infinitely complex. Demure no longer needed to concern himself with the mundane affairs of humans, so trivial were they, so limited and short-sighted. Political machinations, populations milling about like ants in a disturbed hill, lives flickering bright and dull like sparks from a campfire. His former life was only a vague and fading memory without specific names or faces. He saw images but ignored them. He could never go back to what he had been. Instead of simply finishing his story about the dinosaur creature, Steersman Grodin spoke on a tangent about the technical aspects of what the chosen student had just accomplished on his interstellar journey. How they had employed high-order mathematics and dimensional changes to peer into the future. Much the same way the long-necked monster had looked into his tank. "A navigator must do more than observe," Grodin's scratchy voice said over the speaker. "A navigator utilizes what he sees in order to guide spaceships safely through the void. Failure to apply certain basic principles may lead to Highliner disasters and the loss of all lives and cargo aboard." Before any of the new adepts, like Demure, could become pilots into fold space, they must master how to deal with crises such as partially folded space, faulty prescience, the onset of spice intolerance, malfunctioning Holtzman generators, or even deliberate sabotage. Demure tried to envision the fates that had befallen some of his unfortunate predecessors. Contrary to popular belief, navigators did not themselves fold space. The Holtzman engines did that. Navigators used their limited prescience to choose safe paths to travel. A ship could move through the void without their guidance, but that perilous guessing game invariably led to disaster. A guild navigator did not guarantee a safe journey, but he vastly improved the odds. Problems still arose when unforeseen events occurred. Demure was being trained to the limit of the guild's knowledge, which could not include every eventuality. The universe and its inhabitants were in a state of constant change. All of the old schools understood this, including the Bene Gesserit and the Mentats. Survivors learned how to adjust to change, how to expect the unexpected. At the edge of his awareness, his melange tank began to move on its suspensor field and fell into line behind the tanks of the other students. He heard an assistant instructor reciting passages from the Spacing Guild manual. Gas circulation mechanisms hummed around him. Every detail seemed so sharp, so clear, so important. He had never felt so alive. Inhaling deeply of the orange-hued melange, he felt his concerns begin to dissipate. His thoughts drew back into order, sliding smoothly into the neural pathways of his guild-enhanced brain. "Demure! Demure, my brother!" The name swirled with the gas like a whisper in the universe, a name he no longer used now that he had been assigned a guild nav number. Names were associated with individuality. Names imposed limitations and preconceptions, family connections and past histories. They imposed individuality, the antithesis of what it meant to be a navigator. A guildsman merged with the cosmos and saw safe paths through the wrinkles of fate, prescient visions that enabled him to guide matter from place to place, like chess pieces in a cosmic game. "Demure, can you hear me? Demure!" The voice came from the speaker inside his tank, but also from a great distance. He heard something familiar in the timbre, the inflections. Could he have forgotten so much? Demur. He'd almost erased that name from his thoughts. Demur's mind made connections that were becoming less and less important, and his slack mouth formed gurgling words.
Yes, I hear you.
Nudged by its attendant, Demur's tank glided along a paved path toward an immense bulbous building where the navigators lived. No one else seemed to hear the voice. "This is Keter," the transmission continued. "Your brother. You can hear me? Finally, this thing worked. How are you?"
"Keter?"
The fledgling navigator felt his mind fold back into itself, compressing to the remnants of its sluggish pre-guild state, trying to be human again just for a moment. Was that important? This was painful and limiting, like a man putting blinders on himself. But the information was there. Yes, his twin brother, Keter Pilru, human. He got flashes of his father in ambassadorial dress, his mother in guild bank uniform, his brother, like himself, with dark hair and dark eyes, playing together, exploring. Those images had been shunted out of his thoughts, like most everything of that realm, but not quite gone.
"Yes," Demur said. "I know you. I remember."
On Ix, in a shadowed alcove where he used his cobbled-together transmission device, Keter hunched over, desperate to avoid discovery. But this was worth any risk. Tears streaked down his cheeks, and he swallowed hard. The Tleilaxu and the Suboids had continued their rampages and purges, destroying any residue of unfamiliar technology that they found.
"They took you away from me, in the guild testing chamber," Keter said, his voice a husky whisper. "They wouldn't let me see you, wouldn't let me say goodbye. Now I realize you were the lucky one, Demur, considering everything that's happened here on Ix. It would break your heart to see it now." He took a deep, shuddering breath.
"Our city was destroyed not long after the guild took you away from us. Hundreds of thousands are dead. The Beni Tleilaxu now rule here." Demur paused, taking time to slide back into the limited manner of person-to-person communication.
"I have guided a Highliner through fold space, brother. I hold the galaxy in my mind. I see mathematics."
His sluggish words garbled together.
"Now I know why. I know. I feel pain from your connection.
Keter, how?"
"This communication hurts you?"
He drew back from the transmitter, concerned, and held his breath, fearful that one of the furtive Tleilaxu spies might hear him.
"I'm sorry, Demur. Maybe I should..."
"Not important. Pain shifts, like a headache. But different. Swimming through my mind and beyond it."
Demur sounded distracted, his voice distant and ethereal.
"What connection is this? What device?"
"Demur, didn't you hear me? Ix is destroyed. Our world, our city is now a prison camp. Mother was killed in an explosion. I couldn't save her. I've been hiding here, and I'm at great risk while making this communication. Our father is in exile somewhere, on Kaitain, I think. House Vernius has gone renegade. I'm trapped here, alone."
Demur remained focused on what he considered the primary question.
"Communication directly through fold space? Impossible. Explain it to me."
Taken aback at his twin brother's lack of concern over the horrendous news, Keter nonetheless chose not to rebuke him. Demur had, after all, undergone extreme mental changes and couldn't be blamed for the way he was now. Keter could never understand what his twin had been through. He himself had failed the guild's tests.
He had been too fearful and rigid. Otherwise, he too might be a navigator now. Holding his breath, he listened to a creaking sound in the passageway overhead, distant footsteps that faded, whispering voices. Then silence returned, and Kater was able to continue the conversation.
"Explain," Demur said again.
Eager for any kind of conversation, Kater told his brother of the equipment he had salvaged.
"Do you remember Davy Rogo? The old inventor who used to take us into his laboratory and show us the things he was working on?"
"Crippled. Suspensor crutches. Too decrepit to walk."
"Yes. He used to talk about communicating in neutrino energy wavelengths. A network of rods wrapped in silicate crystals."
Pain again.
"You're hurting."
Kater looked around, fearful of the risk he continued to take himself.
"I won't talk much longer."
The tone was impatient. Demur wanted to hear more.
"Continue explanation. Need to know this device."
"One day during the fighting, when I really wanted to talk with you, bits and pieces of his conversation came back to me. In the rubble of a ruined building, I thought I saw a hazy image of him next to me. Like a vision. He was talking in that creaky old voice, telling me what to do, what parts I would require and how to put them together. He gave me the ideas I needed."
"Interesting."
The navigator's voice was flat and bloodless. His brother's lack of emotion and compassion disturbed him. Kater tried to ask questions about Demur's Spacing Guild experiences, but his twin had no patience for the queries and said that he couldn't discuss guild secrets, not even with his brother. He had traveled through Fold Space, and it was incredible. That was all Demur would say.
"When can we talk again?" Kater asked.
The apparatus felt dangerously warm, ready to break down. He would have to shut it off soon. Demur groaned with distant pain, but gave no definite response. Still, even knowing his brother's discomfort, he had a human need to say goodbye, even if Demur no longer did.
"Farewell for now, then. I miss you."
As he spoke the long overdue words, he sensed an easing of his own pain. Odd in a way, since he could no longer be sure his brother understood him as he once had. Feeling guilty, Kater broke the connection. Then he sat in silence, overwhelmed by conflicting emotions. Joy at having spoken to his twin again, but sadness at Demur's ambivalent reactions. How much had his brother changed? Demur should have cared about the death of their mother and the tragic events that had befallen Ix. A guild navigator's position affected all mankind. Shouldn't a navigator be more caring, more protective of humanity? But instead, the young man seemed to have severed all ties, burned all bridges. Was Demur reflecting guild philosophy, or had he become so consumed with himself and his new abilities that he'd turned into an egomaniac? Was it necessary for him to behave that way? Had Demur severed all contact with his humanity? No way to tell yet. Kater felt as if he had lost his brother all over again. He removed the bio-neutrino machine contacts that had temporarily expanded his mental powers, amplifying his thoughts, and thus enabling him to communicate with distant junction. Suddenly dizzy, he returned to his shielded bolt hole and lay down on the narrow cot. Eyes closed, he envisioned the universe behind his lids, wondering what it must be like for his twin. His mind hummed with a strange residue of the contact, a backwash of mental expansion. Demur had sounded as if he were speaking underwater, through filters of comprehension. Now, underlying meanings occurred to Kater, subtleties and refinements. Throughout the evening, in the isolation of his hidden room, thoughts percolated through his mind, overwhelming him like a demonic possession. The contact had sparked something unexpected in his own brain, an amazing reaction. For days he did not leave the enclosure, consumed with his enhanced memories, using the prototype apparatus to focus his thoughts to an obsessive clarity. Hour after hour, the replayed conversation became clearer to him, words and double meanings blossoming like flower petals, as if he traversed his own kind of fold space of mind and memory. Nuances of Demur's dialogue became increasingly apparent, meanings Kater hadn't noticed at first. This gave him only an inkling of what his brother had become. He found it exciting and terrifying. Finally, coming back to awareness an unknown number of days later, he noticed that food and beverage packages lay scattered around him. The room stank. He looked in a mirror, shocked to see that he had grown a scratchy, dark brown beard. His eyes were bloodshot, his hair wild. Kater barely recognized himself. If Kylie Avernius were to set eyes on him now, she would draw back in horror or disdain and send him to work in the dimmest lower levels with the suboids. Somehow, though, after the tragedy of Ix, the rape of his beautiful underground city, his boyish crush on the Earl's daughter seemed irrelevant. Of all the sacrifices Kater had made, that was among the smallest. And he was sure there would be harder ones to come. Before cleaning himself or the hiding place, though, he began preparations for the next call to his brother. Perceptions rule the universe, Bene Gesserit saying. A robo-controlled shuttle left its orbiting highliner in the Lao Jin system and streaked toward the surface of Wallach 9, transmitting appropriate security codes to bypass the Sisterhood's primary defenses. The Bene Gesserit homeworld was just another stop on its long, circuitous route wandering among the stars in the Imperium. Her thick hair beginning to turn gray, her body starting to hint at its age, Gaius Helen Mohiam thought it would be good to be home after many months of other duties, each separate assignment a thread in the vast Bene Gesserit tapestry. No sister understood the entire pattern, the entire weaving of events and people, but Mohiam did her part. With her advancing pregnancy, the Sisterhood had called her home to remain at the mother school until such time as Mohiam delivered the much-anticipated daughter. Only Kwisatz's mother, Anirul, comprehended her true value to the breeding program, how everything hinged on the child she now carried. Mohiam understood that this baby was important, but even the whispers of her other memory, which could always be called upon to offer a cacophony of advice, remained deliberately silent on the subject. The guild shuttle carried only her. Working under the specter of the jihad, the Rachizian manufacturers of the robo-pilot had gone out of their way to make a clunky-looking, rivet-covered device that most vehemently neither emulated the human mind nor looked the least bit human, or even sophisticated for that matter. The robo-pilot transported passengers and materials from a big ship to the surface of a planet, and back again in a well-rehearsed chain of events. Its functions included barely enough programming flexibility to deal with air traffic patterns or adverse weather conditions. The robo-pilot took its shuttle in a routine sequence, from highliner to planet, from planet to highliner. At a window seat in the shuttle, Mohiam reflected on the delicious revenge she had exacted on the Baron. It had been months already, and no doubt he still suspected nothing. But a Bene Gesserit could wait a long time for the appropriate payment. Over the years, as his precious body weakened and bloated from the disease, an utterly defeated Vladimir Harkonnen might even contemplate suicide. Mohiam's vengeful action might have been impulsive, but it was fitting and appropriate after what the Baron had done.
Mother Superior Harishka would not have allowed House Harkonnen to go unpunished, and Mohiam thought her spontaneous idea had been cruelly apt. It would save the sisterhood time and trouble. As the ship descended into the cloud layer, Mohiam hoped this new child would be perfect, because the Baron would no longer be of any use to them. But if not, the sisterhood always had other options and other plans. They had many different breeding schemes. Mohiam was of a type considered optimal for a certain mysterious genetic program. She knew the names of some, but not all, of the other candidates, and knew as well that the sisterhood didn't want simultaneous pregnancies in the program, fearing this might muddle the mating index. Mohiam did wonder, though, why she had been selected again, after the first failure. Her superiors hadn't explained it to her, and she knew better than to ask. And again, the voices in other memory kept their counsel to themselves. "Do the details matter?" she wondered. "I carry the requested daughter in my womb. A successful birth would elevate Mohiam's stature, might even result in her eventual election as Mother Superior by the Proctors when she got much older, depending on how important this daughter really was." She sensed the girl would be very important. Aboard the robo-piloted shuttle, she felt a sudden change of motion. Looking out the narrow window, she saw the horizon of Wallach 9 lurch as the craft flipped over and plunged down, out of control. The safety field around her seat glimmered an unfamiliar, disconcerting yellow. Machine sounds, which had been limited to a smooth whir, now screamed through the cabin, hurting her ears. Lights blinked wildly on the control module ahead of her. The robo's movements were jerky and uncertain. She had been trained to handle crises, and her mind worked rapidly. Mohiam knew about occasional malfunctions on these shuttles, statistically unlikely, exacerbated by the lack of pilots with the ability to think and react. When a problem did occur, and Mohiam felt herself in the midst of one now, the potential for disaster was high. The shuttle plummeted, lurching and bucking. Cloth-like scraps of cloud slapped the windows. The robo-pilot went through the same circular motions, unable to try anything new. The engine flared out, went silent. "This can't be," Mohiam thought. "Not now. Not when I'm carrying this child." Viscerally, she felt that if she could just survive this, her baby would be healthy and would be the one so badly needed by the sisterhood. But dark thoughts assailed her, and she began to tremble. Guild navigators, such as the one in the highliner above her, utilized higher-order dimensional calculations, and they did so in order to see the future, enabling them to maneuver ships safely through the dangerous voids of fold space. Had the Spacing Guild learned of the secret Bene Gesserit program, and did they fear it? As the shuttle hurtled toward disaster, an incredible array of possibilities tumbled through Mohiam's mind. The safety field around her stretched and grew more yellow. Her body pressed against it, threatening to break through. Holding her hands protectively over her womb, she felt a frantic desire to live, and for her unborn child to thrive. And her thoughts went beyond the parochial concerns of a mother and child, to a much larger significance. She wondered if her suspicions might be totally in error. What if some higher force than either she or her sisters could possibly imagine was behind this? Were the Bene Gesserit, through their breeding program, playing God? Did a real God, regardless of the sisterhood's cynicism and skepticism toward religion, in fact exist? What a cruel joke that would be. The deformities of her first child, and now the impending death of this fetus and Mohiam too. It all seemed to add up to something. But if so, who or what was behind this emergency? The Bene Gesserit did not believe in accidents or coincidences. "I must not fear," she intoned, her eyes closed. "Fear is the mind killer.
Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will permit it to pass over me and through me. And when it has gone past, I will turn the inner eye to see its path. Where the fear has gone, there will be nothing. Only I will remain. It was the litany against fear, conceived in ancient times by a Bene Gesserit sister, and passed on to generation after generation. Mohiam took a deep breath, and felt her trembling subside. The shuttle held position momentarily, with her window pointed planetward. The engine sputtered again. She saw the continental mass approaching fast, and made out the sprawling mother school complex, a labyrinthine white stuccoed city with sienna roof tiles. Was the shuttle being sent out of control into the main school, with some terrible explosive force aboard? A single crash could wipe out the heart of the sisterhood. Mohiam struggled against the safety field, but could not break free. The shuttle shifted, and the land disappeared from view. The window cocked upward to reveal the blue-white sun on the edge of the atmosphere. Then her safety field grew clear, and Mohiam realized that the shuttle had righted itself. The engine was on again, a sweet flow of machinery. In the front compartment, the robopilot moved with apparent efficiency, as if nothing had happened. One of its programmed emergency routines must have worked. As the shuttle set down smoothly on the ground in front of the Grand Plaza, Mohiam breathed a long sigh of relief. She rushed to the door hatch, meaning to flee into the safety of the nearest building. But she paused, took a moment to compose herself, and then strode calmly out. A reverend mother had to maintain appearances. When she glided down the ramp, sisters and acolytes swarmed protectively around her. Mother Superior demanded that the shuttle be impounded for a complete overhaul and investigation, seeking evidence of sabotage or confirmation of a simple malfunction. A brusque radio transmission from the highliner above, however, prevented this. Reverend Mother Anirul Sado Tonkin stood waiting to greet Mohiam, beaming with pride, looking very young with her doe-like face and short bronze hair. Mohiam had never understood Anirul's importance, though even the Mother Superior often showed her deference. The two women nodded to each other. In the midst of her fellow sisters, Mohiam was escorted to a safe building. A large contingent of armed female guards had been posted to watch her. She would be pampered and observed carefully until the baby was due. "There will be no more travel for you, Mohiam," Mother Superior Harishka said. "You must remain safely here until we have your daughter."